Welcome to episode number 25 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, leadership, and what it takes to have a wellness culture within your organization. My name is Conrad Weaver, and I hope you're doing well and that you're continually working toward a better you. I hope you're actually doing that. Question: so how does your city or agency deal with first responders with mental health issues? Are there programs or resources in place to help those who are struggling? Or do they treat mental health issues just like physical health issues? They should, right? Well, today I'm talking to Dr. Mildred Betancourt, who developed the Public Safety Wellness Unit for the City of Irving, Texas. She oversees and manages the day-to-day operation of the unit to promote safety, wellness, and resilience for all fire and police personnel. And this is a 24... Plus, it's an award-winning program. In 2023, the City of Irving's Public Safety Wellness Unit received the Destination Zero National Officer Safety and Wellness Award, sponsored by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Stay tuned for this informative and important conversation. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the podcast. I know you're busy and there's a ton of podcasts out there, so I really appreciate you taking time to listen to this one. And I'm also grateful for everyone who's joining us right here on YouTube. Thanks for watching. Please be sure to subscribe no matter what channel you watch or listen from. This really helps us get the word out and lets more people learn about the show. And if you could do me a favor, if you appreciate this program and it's been helpful, please take a minute and rate and review the program. This would mean the world to me and would help us get the word out to more people as well. Thanks again for listening and watching. And now here's my conversation with Dr. Mildred Betancourt. Well, Mildred, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. So glad you're able to join me today.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. This is a great opportunity for me to continue to spread the word and support and offer my assistance to anyone out there who is wanting to start a program or just needs guidance. We're here to help in any way that we can.
Yeah. So first of all, tell us a little bit about your background. Where do you come from? How did you get connected into the public safety world?
Okay. I am a licensed psychologist, and I was hired under the police department to be a part of a community mental health clinic that we have here in Irving for victims of crime in 2010. Previously, I worked for the correctional system in Puerto Rico. And so I transitioned to from working with perpetrators to working with the victims here. I did that for 11 years under the police department. And in 2016, it prompted what prompted peer support was the suicide of a police officer here. Mm-hmm. We got a group together, a steering committee, and we started developing our program, policies, procedures, and that's how we became the Irving Peer Support Program. When we started, I was then overseeing the counseling department there. So that was my 40-hour job. Peer support, it was a voluntary program back then. So the program was so well received that the fire department requested to become part of our program. And that happened because both chiefs had a great relationship. So the fact that we were already providing services, because most of these calls, you'll find fire and police working together. So when we did a debriefing or when we met with the first responders that were impacted, there were firefighters as well. So they requested to be officially part of our peer support program. And that's how that merge happened. Mm-hmm. And in 2021, I highly recommended that they look into considering a full-time peer support program, because having a 40-hour job and overseeing now something that amazed everyone, the fact that services were being utilized, the trust that we built within the first responder community was very well received, but it was challenging for me to maintain both both jobs. So
up until then, that was just all volunteer. Mm-hmm. You were volunteering that. Wow.
Exactly. So one of the things that I did compile data from day one when we started. I started compiling data on every interaction, SISM, one-on-one interventions, trainings, everything we did, I compiled data. So when I presented the need for a full-time program, I had 5 years worth of data to prove that this is something that's being utilized and you need a full-time individual to run this. And so city manager and city council supported the idea. And in 2021, we became a standalone wellness unit. So I was transferred from the police department to the city manager's office. So that was intentional so that the program could be even more effective in terms of privacy, confidentiality, the trust, because I don't have the the supervisory or administrative responsibility with any public safety department. And so that gives us a healthy and a safety distance. And that builds even more trust and confidence in the program within the first responders.
So this is called the Public Safety Wellness Unit, correct?
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what all does that unit, what do you provide for your people? What are the services that you offer?
So we continue to oversee both peer support programs. They have their teams. They continue to do what they do as peer supporters. Whenever they need a consultation or a referral, they contact us. And in addition to peer support, we continue to provide inoculation training for the new recruits. It's an 8-hour training that we provide. When I say first responders and new recruits, I'm including detention officers and dispatchers as well. We service them as well. And we provide quarterly trainings. We provide new supervisors training. We provide wellness check-ins. So we sometimes go to each department and spend some time with the employees, the staff. In-house, our office is off-site. The only people visiting our office are the ones receiving services. So it provides that additional level of privacy. Mm-hmm. We in-house provide crisis intervention, crisis counseling, grief counseling, EMDR, for current and past trauma, biofeedback and neurofeedback to help them and train them to regulate their stress responses. And we additional trainings that we have, and we also service their immediate families.
Boy, this is really, I have a whole ton of questions that have come up in my mind as talking about this. This is really amazing. Now, first of all, these services are provided for all the members of public safety. Is it free of charge or is there a charge for them to come into your office?
No, it's free of charge. I forgot yoga for first responders. So we provide, it's a holistic perspective. We want to be able to provide not just the mental health side of things, but physical, financial trainings, which we also
That's so important.
Facilitate. Exactly.
Yeah.
The question was, is it free? Yes, it's free. Mm-hmm. The city, I'm a City of Irving employee. Our staff is our City of Irving employee. So three things that I think it's important for clinicians to know. And the major stakeholders, let's call them the major stakeholders. Mm-hmm. They, when you read about the hurdles that first responders have for reaching out for mental health services, stigma is the number one.
Sure.
But the the accessibility of services, whether it's because when they finally get the make the decision to call, they find themselves having to wait 2 months, 3 weeks. And so accessibility of service is not that easy. First responders, when they do get the courage that to call, finally call, they need to be seen right away.
Yeah. Not 'cause that can be fatal, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So that phone call could be, between life and death. For a first responder. So the stigma is one of the biggest hurdles. The accessibility of services, whether it's because they're on a wait list, they can't find someone. And the third one is the lack of culturally competent clinicians. And there are many, many well-meaning clinicians who have the passion and want to work with first responders without the proper knowledge and training of what this culture looks like and why there are such intricacies involved within the first responder world that need to be addressed in treatment. And in that, relationship. So those three are the main hurdles that come up over and over in research and literature, and you read articles, and those are the three main categories. So when I was writing the proposal, I made sure that they knew the importance of having a wellness unit within the city. Structure in the way that we are structured is, number one, you have a wellness unit dedicated solely to first responders. Eventually, the conversation in passing in the hallways is, I can't meet with you today because I have an appointment at the wellness unit. And so that does away with the stigma. Mm-hmm. So it's no secret. There is a wellness unit, and this is what we do. Number two, the accessibility of services. We don't have a wait list because we're not structured to become long-term counselors. Mm-hmm. We are structured to be that initial stabilization, and that's why the services that we provide are services that will focus on stabilizing and handing off for long-term counseling to other vetted counselors outside of our offices that can continue working with the family issues, marital issues, financial issues, but we do that initial stabilization. And number three, we are on call. We rotate, and so we make sure that there is a clinician on call 24/7 so that if they need to come in, if they need to speak with someone, there's always going to be someone that they can meet with when they need it. And
so there's not going to be that delay in getting answers or getting help
right. Immediately.
Hmm. Wow. So how did you go about to convince the bean counters to spend the money and to make this a line item in the budget for the city? You know, how did that come about? Because I know that can be a challenge.
Yes. And it was, because when I initially presented it to both chiefs, their response was, we do know this is needed, greatly needed. We know, we see the benefit. If you can find the money somewhere, we'll support you.
Wow.
Yes. And we were blessed. It was the right time. The city of Irving received COVID funds. Mm-hmm. And we were in the middle of COVID working with the trauma and mm-hmm. just the burnout and a vicarious trauma due to COVID and everything else, that they asked me, can you write a proposal and we can use these funds because it's to help our first responder deal with all these stressors. And I said, 100%. So we started with grant funds. Mm-hmm. And the second year, again, the city now has 1 year of data for me to confirm and prove this is an essential service for our first responders. So now we are part of the general funds within the city of Irving. Our department has a number, an identity, a budget. And so, again, I think it's the numbers speak for it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's brilliant. Using that grant money where it wasn't any impact on the city's budget to kind of show a proof of concept mm-hmm. that, hey, this is important. This is, it works. What were those early results? How did the first responders respond to this? Was it an immediate buy-in or was it kind of a slow burn into using your services?
Because we had 5 years of peer support history, mm-hmm. we're not coming in new as I'm not coming in new. Sure. So it was more of a celebration because now mm-hmm. I am not part of the police department. My office is not within a city building. So it was more of a, this is great because now, we know you, you're not part of the police department. You're not part of fire. And so it wasn't hard to get the buy-in. The buy-in was already there and we had built it for 5 years. And so, what we saw was an increase in services, particularly EMDR. Hmm. And when we were able to show that increase in services, then obviously it helped for them understand they need it and they want it and they're using it. Hmm. So we've given them permission and here we are. And I think when you give someone permission, sometimes even if they want it, but they don't feel like they have permission because of the stigma. Sure. Fear of repercussion, but we are giving them permission mm-hmm. to use these services.
So what's the typical process that a first responder will go through? Perhaps they're struggling with something. They give your office a call. What happens in the next week or two? What's the process there?
Well, what happens immediately, because someone walks in, he's going to be or she's going to be seen right away. So we'll do that initial assessment intake. We want to know what's going on. We'll provide them with the information. Consent forms are signed. We may do initial testing and assessments just to identify the severity of the symptoms that they may be exhibiting. And so if they call and they can't make it in that same day, then we'll make an appointment, the soonest availability, which could be the next day, depending on their shift, because I don't know of other about other places, but in Irving, mostly our firefighters, they commute 35, 45, an hour and a half to come work here. And I guess their work schedule allows that. It's convenient. But then when we want to schedule an appointment, we have to take that into consideration. So sure. We have to commute an hour and a half to get here. We want to be able to schedule the appointment when they get off shift, and that way it's convenient for them. So again, accessibility and convenience. If our first responders they sense a difficulty, anything that gives them an excuse to say, oh, you know what? I can't, I won't be able to. So we try to make it as simple, seamless as possible. So when do you get off work? And so come right after shift and so those are the most common things that we see. For police, it's a little more flexible for them because, like I said, this has become normal. And so if they need to come in, sometimes they just call their sergeant. I need to speak with someone. They take them off for whatever amount of time they need, and they can come up here and meet with someone.
Mm-hmm. What's been the overall result of this? How has the calling in sick been reduced? What are those long-term results that it can happen when you have healthier first responders in your agency?
So unfortunately, because we're only 2 years in, we haven't really gathered that data as to how this is now affecting turnover, how is this affecting sick leave. And so we haven't yet. That is something that it's going to be my next step, because proving efficacy, we have many, stories. We have many testimonies, but we need the data. We need, and so because we're 2 years in, it's too early yet to see any significant trend in that direction. But that's a good question, and that's something that we are considering, because the proving the efficacy of the services is pivotal in any industry.
Because that helps continue the city leaders to say yes to putting this in the budget.
Right. Mm-hmm. However, the one stat that we do have, and because it's just that important, the number of critical high risk situations that we intervene and have intervened throughout the years, meaning active suicide, possible homicide situations, inpatient program referrals, and so that data we do have. And so that in itself has been able to open the eyes of the major stakeholders. And when they realize they walk among us, they're, you know, they're here every day and we don't know and that this is happening. So when I present this data, no, this is what we deal. This is what we're doing. Just numbers, because it's confidential. That in itself is very powerful for them to know, wow, if it was 5, if it was 10, these could have possibly been or ended up in 10 suicide or whatever the number might have been that year.
And then the ripple effect of that can be really impactful.
Yes.
So, I mean, I know the ripple effect from just one, you know, it's person taking their own life is devastating, right? Mm-hmm. And then that can also lead to more people following suit. And and when you have... when you help have a program like this that helps break down that stigma of people saying, hey, you know, I need to talk to someone, that makes a huge difference.
And one of the things that a few weeks ago, we had a situation where, and I'm sure it happens many, many times. First responder was hesitant to receiving the services or the recommendations, and what are they going to say? You know, what will be the repercussion? And so we go, I mean, that's something that we deal with on a daily basis, and we explain it to them over and over and over. And so what was very, it was funny, because the peer member working with me on that situation didn't know himself that that individual had a colleague who had gone through the services, and no one in the office knew. And so I reassure the individual, even our peer members, if they are not involved, they don't know. They won't know. They don't have to know. And so that was, it was a great example to the testament of how important it is to gain that trust and stand by that trust and really have evidence to show that, no, this is effective because this is how we do things.
I heard recently there's a, and I won't name the city, but there's a major city in the U.S. where they had a really an amazing wellness unit. And I've heard through the grapevine that recently they had some changes in it, and they decided to now let upper management know when an individual is seeing a therapist. I thought, oh, that can be devastating.
Yes, I don't know why they would have the need to let anyone know. I don't think that, I don't agree with that. Based on my experience here, if we did that, the department would close down.
Sure, mm-hmm. sure. Because no one would come. If, mm-hmm. if I'm a firefighter and I come to see you and I know that that's going to be reported up the chain, I'm not going to come.
Exactly. Exactly. And I don't know if that has to do with how they are structured, if they are under a public safety department, meaning police or fire, mm-hmm. And they feel compelled because of their administrative responsibilities towards their management. Mm-hmm. But that was pretty much the reason why I had 11 years of working under the police structure. So I know how that structure works. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it's bad. I'm saying that it is. It is what it is. It is the police right. structure, and it exists because of the work that they do. Mm-hmm. But when you insert a social service program within that structure, they are not compatible. And so trying to fit a social service program within a rigid structure such as police or fire, it's not compatible. So when I requested this needs to be separated from both, it's because I want to be able to look at the first responders in the eyes and say, I don't report to either chiefs, and they don't call me to request information because this is not part of their department. So they don't need the information. That is huge. I think that's, I don't see any other way because of the semi-military structure within police right. and fire. And again, because of the nature of the work that they do, it needs to be that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this particular, unit was within, one of those agencies within, mm-hmm. within that agency itself. Yeah. And so that can create issues.
And you may come across a chief that understands and will say, you know what? No, I don't. But you may come across a person who, for whatever reason, thinks they need to know and they'll push it and they'll demand the information. And then that puts the clinician in a bind because now you have a responsibility with your client, but you're also getting paid and you have a responsibility with your boss. Mm-hmm. And so our structure does away with that.
Mm-hmm. How can this could be a great benefit for, first responders, law enforcement. Like I have a story of a person who, was put out from her agency because of mental health issues and some other things. And then the city came and didn't want to follow through with providing resources for her. And if this particular agency would have had what you guys have, it would have been a non-issue. Because she would have been able to get the help that she could have received, without the agency knowing.
That's correct. And I have to credit the city of Irving has been, oh my goodness, a trailblazer when it comes to mental health. The city of Irving provides our first responders with 30-day mental health leave. No out-of-pocket expense when they have to go into an inpatient program that doesn't tap into their sick time either.
Wow.
They develop a policy where after a critical incident within that month, the first responder can take a mental health day. No questions asked. All he needs to say is, I'm taking my mental health day. Mm-hmm. If they need more time, then they will go through their supervisor. But they get one day off for mental health, and the ability of us having, number one, the clinical background to be able to assess someone here on the spot and determine, no, this person needs to go home, this person needs this or that. And then we also help with the case management and get them connected with services. So we're not sending them home on a vacation. Mm-hmm. We're justifying the leave with symptoms and need for services. And so it's well respected, not questioned. This is what this person needs.
100%. So it's really become, it's become part of the culture there. Mm-hmm. Just that whole culture of from the fire and from the police departments.
Yes.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. I saw something on your website that I want to ask you about. It was a thing said primary prevention.
Oh, yes.
Can you explain what that is?
So actually, it's primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention services. Within the prevention world, we do a lot of primary intervention, meaning all these campaigns, psychoeducational campaigns, free drug zone and things like that, those are primary mm-hmm. interventions for younger generations that have not started using drugs. For example, primary services to prevent a disease or a disorder. Mm-hmm. By providing information, you want to prevent the likelihood of an individual developing a disease, disorder, or an addiction. Mm-hmm. And so our primary services or primary intervention starts with the inoculation training with the new recruits. We want to be able to prevent the likelihood of these new recruits coming in like newlyweds with all of these ideals and expectations and finding out fairly quickly that it's not what they thought it was. Mm-hmm. And we prepare them so that they have the information, not 20 years after the fact, but before they even start. And so this is what you can expect. This is what's going to happen. This is what you're going to feel and experience. And this is how you can reach out for help. These are the services out there. We bring in experienced veteran officers and firefighters to talk about their own experience of trauma. So if you don't believe the theoretical side of it, here's the experience talking. Mm-hmm. And so our primary intervention starts with inoculation training.
You know, that's pretty amazing because typically, historically, first responder agencies, you know, what I've been told is that, yeah, they had a couple of hours of, we talked about, you know, death by PowerPoint, you know, here's a PowerPoint slide on what you might experience. And then some people have even told me that their mental health training was, you're going to see stuff. And that's about it. Mm-hmm. You know, so, well, so this takes it a whole step further and yes, is much more important.
It's an 8-hour training, and we even bring spouses. And so if they're married, they're coming in, or if they are considering getting married at some point, we bring spouses. And so spouses will speak to, this was my experience. This has been my experience. This is how we've worked around certain issues. This is the information that is shared. This is, and so we want to be able to give them a pretty good idea, forecast of what they're getting into.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's powerful. So this could be a model that other cities, other agencies, other places could really be modeled after. How can people learn more about it? And do you guys do consulting with other agencies around the country?
I am very happy, honored, and proud to say that last year, Destination Zero and the National Law Enforcement Memorial Program in Washington, D.C., we were chosen as the Comprehensive Wellness Program of the Year in 2023 under Destination Zero. So our information, if they go into the Destination Zero website and go under the 2023 winners, they can find our information there. Policies, procedures, how we're structured, more information on what our primary, secondary, tertiary programs are, why we structured it the way we did to be intentional about the services that we provide. And so I get phone calls. We had an inoculation training on Monday and three first responders from other agencies came in to audit the the training and take that with them and use what they can and apply what they can within their own department. So I am happy to, people call me, so I am more than happy to provide whatever information, consultation. So they can start by clicking on the Destination Zero and taking a look at our information on that website.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how does this work? How does that bring fulfillment and joy to you personally?
Oh my goodness. It's not just me. I can speak for my clinicians as well, because we've had this conversation. We have such an honorable job. When I think about calling 911 and having police or fire medics come and help me, and I've had that happen, I'm sure most of us had, and see how they respond. They don't care who you are. That's their job. And they're going to treat you and provide you with the help that you need. And the fact that we get to help them, the fact that in the worst case scenario, we have been able to save even their lives, that has no words. I don't have words for that. I can tell you that coming to work for me is exciting. It's just exciting. I don't remember the last time I ever dreaded a Sunday, because next day is Monday. Mm-hmm. If anything, I'm expecting, right? What is next? What we can do next to help them? What other enhancement? What other program? What other idea? And so it has changed the way I approach mental health in its entirety. And it's made a believer out of me once again, because I have seen the turnaround. I have seen the benefit. And although we have many, many anecdotal testimony, information, it doesn't get old. Every time someone comes back, and even family members now, because we are providing services to them, it just knowing that we are part of that paradigm shift in the first responder world is an awesome feeling and an honor. Yes. Yeah.
Our communities need healthy first responders. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think you guys are really a model for that. And hopefully people watching or listening to this program will reach out and learn more about what you guys are doing and bring those kind of services to their local communities, because that's what we need.
And children need healthy parents.
Absolutely.
And wives and husbands need healthy spouses. And so the community needs healthy first responders for sure. But the family, and one of the things that I wanted to also emphasize and stress, we involve the family because they are the silent recipients of vicarious trauma, and they don't even know it. They don't know that some of the depression, anxiety, anger, and behaviors that they have and experience at home, it's part of what the first responder is bringing to the house without even knowing. And so educating them as well. We started this year through another grant that we received, parenting for first responders classes, because parenting also looks a little different in the first responders world.
Sure. And dad or mom's gone for 24 hours or 48 hours at a time, and that looks different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so important. Wow. That's amazing what you guys are doing. So let me ask you this, and you may not know the exact numbers, but do you know approximately kind of what percentage of the budget this organization, what your organization takes for the city?
I don't know the percentage, but I know how much our budget is in comparing it to the general fund's budget. And if I were a mathematician, which I'm not, but I'm going to venture to say it's 0.000000. Comparing it to the budget is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. But yes. It'll be interesting to see 5 years from now when you have some data to see, okay, how much did this save the city, you know, in workman's comp issues and, you know, overtime because people were out sick or whatever, you know, how much did that save the city? Because I'm sure it'll save millions.
And that is it has to be a priority in my next project because, again, we have to prove efficacy, not just anecdotal information. And I don't know if you know this, but Texas is one of the states that has made PTSD a compensable injury. And so when one of our first responders has identified symptoms and we can assess them and send them off after a critical incident, or they are verbalizing symptoms that are congruent with with a PTSD diagnosis, the city of Irving then runs that through workers' comp because it is a compensatory injury.
That's awesome. I wish all states would be doing that because that's so important.
I don't know of any other state. I do know of.
Yeah, I think California does in some way, but they're always kind of kind of a leader in that kind of thing as well. But there's not very many states who do that. So that's important. So I want to ask you this, and we'll kind of start wrapping it up. But so if there is a critical incident, maybe there's a mass shooting, maybe there's a weather incident, maybe there's some kind of a major fire. Do you guys provide any kind of on the ground support for those first responders on scene?
On scene, if it's needed, yes. On scene is a little tricky because they're doing what they're doing.
Right.
And the only intervention that we will probably, and we have, is more of supportive safety, food, water. It's almost impossible to provide any clinical intervention when they are on scene and still working. So we try not to unless we are called by the supervisor because we have a first responder who's completely decompensating on scene. That's very different. What I did create was a major incident and disaster response so that when we do have a major incident, which we don't want, but this is the world we live in. Major shooting incident. We do have a policy to where a structure policy of how our first responders or the first responders involved will receive the mental health services that they will need after that major incident occurs. So we do have a policy to where any peer support team organization that wants to provide services, that's great. But we are at a point right now, that's what I was, we were talking before we started, that there are so many teams, so many programs that we have developed this great networking relationship that we have local departments with well-trained first responders in peer support that will be part of that networking or response. They will come in. It'll be very organized. We will know who's on site providing services to our first responders. And so that we do have a policy for major and disaster response, mental health response for our first responders.
So even though you have now this wellness unit, you still utilize those volunteer teams of peer supporters to help support this. So your department is kind of a step above that to really provide some more professional guidance and resources and help for these first responders.
Yes. And in a major incident, if our first responders and even some of our peer support members are affected, they won't be in any shape to provide. So we will tap on those outside resources to come and support and help us.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thank you for your leadership in that, and the work that you guys are doing is amazing. You know, I don't know if you were aware of this, or maybe you were even there, but we premiered our film PTSD 911 in Irving, the city of Irving.
Yes, I was there.
Or you were there. Okay, great. Yes. I thought you probably would have been, so I wasn't sure. Mm-hmm.
But, yes. Awesome. Excellent work. Yes.
Yeah, we're really excited to bring this, you know, to kind of spreading the word around the country and through this podcast, kind of continuing those conversations, mm-hmm. and helping people to learn about people like you and the work you're doing to really make a difference in our first responder
yes.
community. So for me, as just a civilian, I want to say thank you. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
You are very welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Betancourt, for spending time with me today on the podcast. And thanks to all of you who have taken time to listen, watch, and especially those of you who have left a review. I really appreciate it. And if you haven't left a review, what are you waiting on? Please do so. I want to be sure I'm bringing content to you that you want to hear, and your reviews help me. And remember, you are not alone. If you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can dial 988 for help. Be sure to tune in next week for another interview with an amazing first responder. Until then, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.